The Pentagram, dedicated to Henry Farman. In the year of the primal force, in the dawn of terrestrial birth, man mastered the mammoth and horse, and man was the lord of the earth. He made him an hollow skin from the heart of an holy tree. He compassed the earth therein, and man was the lord of the sea. He controlled the vigorous steam, he harnessed the lightning for hire, he drove the celestial team, and man was the lord of the fire. Deep mouthed from their thrones, deep seated, the choirs of the eons declare the last of the demons defeated. The man is the lord of the air. Arise, O man, in thy strength, the kingdom is thine to inherit. Till the high gods witness at length that man is the lord of his spirit.
So Kevin had asked me to call him a few minutes early just to, so we could get our Skype setup going. Kevin, every time I've spoken to Kevin, we've had some sort of Skype issue. So we just...
Yeah.
And then just 2 seconds ago, he starts to ask me about my icon, Skype icon, which is actually the cover for the Happy Creatures book. And maybe we'll just... I just want to repeat that basically that last minute or two, because this is exactly what I wanted. These are the themes that I wanted to speak to you about.
Right on, yeah. So do you want me to start or?
But, sure. I guess I'll just say, so Kevin says, hey, did you the bars on the window on the book cover and, were they meant to look like a heart? And I said, well, I thought they looked like rabbit ears, and I on the TV behind those bars is an old school TV where the antenna, they used to call those TV antennas rabbit ears. So it's sort of like I tried to line it up that the rabbit ears of the bars were coming out of the TV like also antenna, but it's like a heart antenna. It's both a message of love as well as imprisonment. It's sort of playing that dichotomy. And it was very much the rabbit plus love. And Kevin, what would you said that we ended this with the idea of Mott?
Right. Like if you look at the heart logo, it's like a mirror of the flower of Mott, because like it's generally like a shorthanded hieroglyph of like, like a feather, but the inside curves into itself a bit. So if you look at the logo, it looks like two feathers of Mott kind of mirrored together. And, Mott has the 42 principles of the Egyptian afterlife. So it's funny because I think if you add T and V together, when you do the English gematria, I believe you get 42. So we've got the rabbit ears, the feather of Mott, TV, 42. And
then you said about the rabbit. So this is you've done a series of films called Thin Film or Membrane.
Right, a thin skin or membrane. Yeah.
Sorry.
No worries. I took it like out of the dictionary, like literally right out of the dictionary. So it's got that, I don't know, maybe that's how they explain it or something. I think that's the definition.
So here we have the idea of rabbits, Sirius, and passageways through the television, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is sort of... These are the themes that are swirling around my head the last few weeks. These are themes that are, I guess, fairly common in our circles. But there's something specifically about even this idea of Mott being, sort of where she's balancing your heart against a feather. This
right.
is in the underworld. This is after you die. So... Mm-hmm. My sort of thought that 2001 A Space Odyssey if he's going to Saturn, if Dave Bowman is going to Saturn, not Jupiter, is he going to the land of the dead? And then there's the idea that, like, even with Poltergeist, the movie Poltergeist, where the spirits are coming through the television, and this is a specific line that I keep coming back to.
It's the mirror, right? So the Saturn is the mirror of Jupiter, in a sense. And so all throughout 2001, you have this mirror thing. But you were talking about the original television being literally a mirror.
Yes. So the guy, Chris Myers, in Sync Book 1, has this one passage where he says, hey, the guy, William Crookes, who invented the Crookes tube, which is how they made the TV, he was trying to contact spirits through a mirror, specifically a black mirror, mind you. That might be important. So he's trying to scry in this black mirror and contact spirits. And in this process, he comes up with the idea for the Crookes tube, which is essentially the basis of the television. So here we have trying to contact spirits through this mirror, but it becomes like that technology gets perfected as the television. So is the television bringing through spirits, or is it a thin film to the other side? And then how do we, what do we think that other side is? Like, you know, there's the classic synchromistic sort of idea of like, oh, it's this wonderful, joyful world. And then there's this other idea of like, is this somehow dead? Is this the land of the dead? And do we need to make a distinction there? But these are the sort of ideas that are swirling around my head.
Well, isn't television just an antichrist feedback machine?
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, Crookes is trying to make a Crookes tube. He's essentially trying to inject electricity into a scrying stone, much like Dr. John Dee employed with Kelly in his Enochian magic. What Dee and Kelly were able to produce with their work with simply a polished black stone is really all the human being needs to accomplish to achieve transcendence. So to then feel that you need to inject electricity into a scrying stone is to take away the role of the human being and give some sort of imprisoned electricity the weight of the work. It allows the human being to be lazy. It allows the human being to be controlled. I think you turn a labyrinth into a maze without an exit in this case. Is it necessary? It's probably a necessary step in the evolution of human being and mass consciousness. You know, you have to go beyond the infinite. But it would seem to me that the television would play Saturn to the scrying stone of Dean Kelly's, that would be Jupiter, if I'm understanding it in this model.
Well, there's something interesting in that. You know, I've been meditating on the 2001 A Space Odyssey connection to the whole membrane and rainbow bridge concept and such. And, you know, the really interesting thing is that, you know, to go, you know, beyond Jupiter is Saturn. And when you're ascending the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, especially in particular initiatory orders such as like the AA and other Crowleyan work, the abyss between the world of the divine and the material world, or like the known human universe, is a gap known as the abyss between Jupiter and Saturn. So when you get to Saturn, you become no man. That's a space. Saturn on the Tree of Life really represents this primordial space, this primordial, the womb of all things, you know. So if you think about staring into the television or staring into Saturn or staring into a black stone, it's kind of like you're looking at this space of total potential, you know. And, you know, when you think about Saturn's role in the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, it tends to transmit the energy of wisdom, which is Chokmah, which is a reflection of the will of Kether, the unmanifested, to come into manifestation. So I think there's an interesting thing, you know, television can be used in a million ways, but just as a as an instrument, it seems like it's almost a really interesting, you know, the black screen is like Saturn, the womb of potential, and it gets informed by the electrical impulse of the imagination or the active imagination in Chokhmah, you know. So I think there's definitely a really important thing about the staring into the black space and allowing variety of forms to be integrated into consciousness through them, because I think that's what essentially the black stones were used for back in the day, was a form of, you know, shamanism and stuff, and integration of, you know, wider variety of energies and stuff. But I'm kind of going on for a while. But
No, that's it.
I think you hit it right off the, you hit the nail right on the head, because the question is, I guess what I'm asking is there any literal spirit contact going on? And at the same time, what I've come to the idea of the monolith, if the idea that the monolith is the movie screen, in one sense we have the idea of Dave Bowman exiting the movie screen or us getting out of the illusion, and at the same time, the monolith, by using such a sort of strange object that's nondescript in many ways, it's literally that the viewer can project whatever they want onto it. So everyone who views 2001 is going to project their own thoughts and perceptions onto that screen. So it's that shiny black rock is literally what you project your subconscious onto. So are you just getting a view inside yourself? Is it a mirror? Or is it that there's something coming through that's and we can get into some hair-splitting semantics here, but something that is not you, if that makes sense.
Well, I want to ask Kevin something. You, Kevin.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So I cannot lately, I have not been able to look at 2001 because of what I've been studying through, like, looking at the mirrors as, like, a clefotic manipulation. So, like, I see the paths of David Bowman and Frank Poole as one is ascending the path that is the path of descent from Ema as far as the light goes, but that Frank is doing the opposite path, which is the clefotic path, which is the mirrored path, right? So you have the name of Tetragrammaton gets flipped with the four klipot. And so if you look at the four worlds as the flip name, then in 2001 A Space Odyssey with the European system, you have the four worlds represented literally. So you're ascending section by section the tree. And so, and I feel like there's, it feels so overt. Could you speak to that a little bit?
I'd hate to ask, but could you remind me who Frank is in Space Odyssey?
Frank is the other astronaut who dies. So so throughout the film, you'll see that they play with mirrors a lot. So, and usually the only way you can tell is that the hose for their spacesuits will flip. So you're looking at a reversed image. And so there's certain indicators throughout it that let you know that it's not a mistake. Like, my favorite example is when Dave is drawing the astronauts in hibernation, and they'll show you what he's looking at, and then they'll show you what he's drawing, and he'll have it flipped in his drawing. So he's drawing not what he's looking at, but what he knows to be true. And so this is the thing, is with the clipote, they look at that like it literally manipulates perception through a reversal. So everything gets flipped. And so it seems like then when he's showing the drawings to Hal and he's like, oh, these are very nice renderings, Dave, you're improving greatly or whatever he says. It's like you can see he flips past the drawing that they showed you him drawing earlier, where it shows his actual perception. And so and then shortly around that same time, you have a chess game that's going on between Frank and Hal, and Hal manipulates Frank into making it seem like a move is forced when it's not actually. And Frank just concedes, like he goes with the program. And so I look at Hal as the substitute Keter, like he's like the Illuminati eye, like substitute reality. in the same way that the projector that you're looking at in the first scene of the movie, when you see the sun, it's taken to be the projector behind you, is literally a substitute reality. So you're like, from the get-go, you're looking at a cliphotic representation rather than the actual perception. Does that make sense?
I definitely get what you're looking at there. I wish I could speak more to the 2001 connections with Frank and the mirror and the flipping stuff. But I can't say I'm like finding a stream to sip from on that. Like I haven't watched the film in a long enough time, but I guess what I could say, if we're talking about like mirrors and flipping and inversions, it's been a really big thing for me lately. Because I've been exploring some of the mysteries of, you know, like the mysteries of the membrane in a way, which is, it's very interesting. I don't know how quite to start with it, but there's a lot of movies coming out right now, including the movie Upside Down with Kirsten Dunst.
I saw that.
And as I move into like deeper occult studies, I'm learning what averse symbolism actually means. So, you know, inverted pentagrams, inverted triangles, they actually have a lot of misconceptions surrounding them. But, you know, the inverted pentagram, just for example, people take that to, you know, point toward evil and wrongdoing and, you know, just dark stuff or whatever. But the inverted pentagram actually just means to highlight the descent of spirit into matter, because when you put an upright pentagram, your spirit point is the most upright single point of the upward pentagram, you know? So when you flip that, that is then bringing spirit down into the foreground, you know, bringing spirit into matter. So when we're looking at averse symbolism or mirrored things and flips, from our world, we think Earth time is all straight up, you know, but from, if we were having the spiritual perspective or the perspective from above the abyss or through the membrane, what we would be looking at is, you know, that the pentagram or the triangle would be upright in that dimension. So to us, inverted stuff kind of highlights the perspective of the spiritual dimension, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. And there's the idea that you flip and you reverse something. And so, and then you have multiple levels to, yes, something is flipped, and the idea of a screen or a membrane that could be veiling the way to actually work with it. Like, you think you're doing one thing and you're actually doing another, is an idea that gets proposed in a lot of the commentary I've been looking at. And so it's like, there's a difference between something being physically, like, you could be looking at something as a positive thing, like you know, the upside down cross is a really classic example, beyond even just like the Catholic interpretation of, who is it, Paul that gets hung upside down, or Peter, I forget. But the idea of humility, right, with the upside down cross, everyone looks at the upside down cross, and they're like, oh, this is evil or whatever. But even the tree of life itself, which people are like, this is the tree of life, is literally a divided star that's in perfect, you know, every line would be the same length, and you have a perfect geometrical figure from which you can derive all the Platonic solids. And yet you've taken that and you split it into two. And so it gets very tricky when I'm talking, like, if you get into talking about the Klipo, because people look at that as a very, like, you know, demonic thing. Yet the idea that gets proposed, at least in 15th century text, is that they're just taking advantage of a situation, and they're not necessarily evil. They're like machines that just run. They just do what they do, and there's nothing. There's just how they work. And so when the exile happens, when the tree gets divided, they rush in. And though they're not the cause of the split tree, by them taking advantage of it, they hold it in place as it is.
Right.
Is the idea.
Can I point out the idea that when we spoke earlier about the idea of putting electricity into something, Kevin mentioned No Man, which we've talked about in the last few weeks. The idea that in the that actually comes from the Odyssey, that Odysseus, when he's battling the Cyclops, just as Dave Bowman battles Hal, he's battling the Cyclops, and he says, "I am No Man." He asks, "What is your name?" He says, "I am No Man," and that's actually how he defeats the Cyclops, because when he pierces the Cyclops' eye, which takes us to Oedipus, and you've mentioned Peter, which if anyone listened to the most recent Synchronize, this is all very important, the idea of taking out the eye with Peter. Anyway, the movie Funeral Parade of Roses, which we know influenced Stanley Kubrick, it is actually a character named Peter who plucks out his eye. Anyway, so in the original Odyssey, Odysseus says to the first Cyclops, "My name is No Man," and then he pokes out his eye, and the guy starts screaming, and the other Cyclops say, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" And he says, "No man is in here. No man is killing me." And they go, "Oh, okay, I guess you're fine," and they keep going. So now Crowley takes this, plays with this, and he says, when it says, "I am Isis, no man has unveiled me," he's saying, well, it's not that you can't unveil Isis. You have to become no man to unveil Isis.
Right, right.
So it's this idea of becoming no man or Bowman. And here we see Bowman doing this. My work with the King Kill is basically showing the same thing, that this is the ego death, becoming the no man, but this is accompanied by the descent of spirit into matter, the lightning flash coming down the Kabbalistic tree. So when we talk about putting electricity into something and become, and at the same time we're talking about becoming no man, are we not talking about the same thing? To have the descent of spirit into matter is essentially that electric lightning flash down the tree.
Well, precisely, and like really interesting about that, some of the notes I took last night will totally like link up with your King Kill stuff and some of the serious stuff that we'll probably get into. But interestingly enough, you know, Bowman basically sacrifices himself to the abyss and becomes the crowned and conquering child by the end of the film. You know, he becomes that space child. So, you know, in the Crowley initiation sequences, there's basically the prince or the holy guardian angel or the true self is the center of the tree at Tifereth. So when one dies and becomes no man, one kills the king, that makes the prince the new king. And so the prince is this, is the, like the focal point of that. The prince is the child, you know? So like the prince is what lies beyond the death of the king. And the prince is that spirit that is veiled in the king, you know.
Oh, so, Jesus, like, that's... can I throw something in here that just occurred to me? Our musician, Prince, decided at some point to no longer have a name. He was the artist formerly known as Prince, but he's essentially a no man at that point, right? He has no name.
Oh, that is awesome. That is so
right.
Good.
He's also purple, right, which is blue and red, which is the two pillars becoming one pillar.
Right, and that's exactly, and the really interesting thing about all that, and I wish I had my Space Odyssey homework done, but the whole idea, I think, about Sirius is that it's the sun behind the sun, you know? So on this side of the membrane, the sun is the sun, but on the other side of the membrane, Sirius is the sun.
Exactly.
And so in our world, the sun is the father god, is the king, but behind the king is the prince, Sirius, you know? And it, Sirius, the prince, the middle pillar, Tifereth, all of it points toward this androgynous current that is beyond the king or the queen, you know? And that's the child that Bowman becomes in the end, you know? So there's a lot, definitely a lot, the whole child and Sirius thing is the idea that, you know, on the Masonic tracing board, you've got the pillars of the sun and the moon on the left and right as Jacob and Boaz, but in the middle, you've got the middle pillar where they often place the blazing star, who is the child of the sun and the moon, you know, Horus. So you've got Horus, Sirius, David Bowman as the child, you know, it's like, there's a whole kind of language for this, basically, you know, tetragrammaton in a way, you know, being expressed in Bowman's journey, I guess, you know.
What about Donnie Darko? So here we have, because when I, so I didn't say this last week and I don't want to go into the whole thing, but basically when I saw 2001 was playing on the big screen about a week ago, I had the chance to go see it and I ended up taking a heroic dose before seeing it. And you know, at the end, when he's going through the Stargate, there's one aspect of the Stargate sequence where you see this sort of like exploding star type thing. It's just this white sort of like burn on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as I was highly inebriated, that I didn't need 3D goggles. Like at some point, the movie became a 3D movie for me. And in that particular image, that bubble came way off the screen. And then I realized only a day or two later that that's essentially what Donnie Darko sees in the movie theater when it's Frank, again, it's Frank, the rabbit, says to him, like,
you ever seen a portal?
Yeah, you ever seen a portal? And he has this sort of wormy, bubbling tube come off the movie screen.
Well, now, I thought that that scene actually, first of all, you're looking at a clock in Evil Dead, and that it looks as though you're like, it's not the same thing that comes out of the chest that shows the line of, it's like the arrowhead.
Yes.
But it actually looks as though the picture is burning a hole more.
Yes. But see, that's what, so in the Stargate sequence, it actually looks like if you were to burn film, which takes us to the idea of if Bowman's trying to exit Plato's cave and trying to get out of the movie. It actually looks like if you ever seen imagery of when they burn film, and sometimes people will project that. Like,
sure.
And I'm trying to think of a good there was something – God, I can't think of what it was. But there was something where they actually had – at the end of Head. I think at the end of Head, right, they actually show the logo comes up and then the film melts. Now, Head is also these people trapped inside a movie – trying to escape. Well, to me, the Stargate was essentially that same thing. So what I was looking at was not necessarily a star exploding, but the film melting, like burning. And that's exactly what you're saying. That's how I viewed it as well.
Almost like an acid burned the film, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's funny. I just happen to be looking here at my notes where I'm like, Sirius is the sun behind the sun. And I write two suns in the sunset and Final Cut Star Wars. So, you know, in Pink Floyd's The Final Cut, the last song on there is called Two Suns in the Sunset, where he goes, Two Suns in the Sunset could be the human race's run. And I play that album with Star Wars, which has Tatooine with the two suns in the sunset. But I like that we're just now talking. I'm like trying to remember like final cuts in films that have done that, where they burn up the film. I was thinking they did that in Fight Club, but they just show you the cock, like, when they cut the picture there, but I don't know. I felt like it was worth mentioning.
Does the cock have the alchemical significance of being a rooster? Like it's a cock. What does a cock do but signal the new dawn?
Oh, that's great.
Right, I'm Year of the Cock, by the way. So I've thought about that.
I am a cock, but. People have told me. So just as we were talking, it occurs to me that Frank – so we have Frank Poole is the other astronaut and Dave Bowman. So now here's Donnie Darko, sort of DD as opposed to a DB, a sort of mirror again, DD and Frank. I'm sorry. I don't know if that does anything for me, but that was something that occurred to me, is that obviously Frank
It does. Well, you have David Bowman in the first place is Dalit Vav Dalit, which is two doors connected. And so you could say that Donnie Darko, in a sense, is two doors connected as well, if you take it as DD Dalit Dalit.
Right.
Which is a mirror of Yud-Heh Vav-Heh, which is two windows connected. So Hey Vav-Heh.
Oh,
and then
yeah,
the two
yeah.
Heys are Bina and the Malkut. So you have, you know, yeah.
I like that. That's awesome. You know, I also was thinking there's Amy Winehouse, I noticed, like, I think she passed away on July 23rd, 2011. And I don't know why, you know, I was, like, taking note of the serious holiday then, because that's the day that Robert Anton Wilson was supposedly contacted by beings from Sirius. And so on July 23rd, 2011, Amy Winehouse passed away. And for whatever reason, the album cover for her album called Frank was posted in the article about her death. And the album Frank of hers is actually Amy Winehouse walking two dogs. One of them you can see in the picture on the album, but the other one is off the album cover. So I thought it was really interesting that, you know, July 23rd, that album is highlighted with the two dogs, Sirius A and Sirius B, only one of which you can actually see on the cover. And then Sirius A, I believe, is the actual binary star you can't see in the night sky. So I just thought that was funny. That album is called Frank. It invokes, you know, all the 42 Donnie Darko stuff and brings everything back to Sirius.
That's fascinating. I didn't know she had that. I don't really know her music, but I remember when she died, I didn't even realize it was on July 23rd. All that I remember from when she died was my thought at the time was her name is Winehouse, which made me think of a sort of Jesus archetype. And I said, oh, I wonder what'll happen in 3 days. If the Christ figure's dead, I wonder what'll happen in 3 days. Uh-huh. And I remember 3 days later, one of the major headlines was about some guy who had died like during an operating thing and was clinically dead for longer than anyone had been dead before and then woke back up. And it was like, oh, so here you have Amy Winehouse dies and 3 days later this dead man rises.
I just had my mind completely blown with. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh no, go ahead.
So I just for resonant synchronicity purposes, I decided to watch the film The Gray with Alien the other day, and simultaneously, like a mashup, kind of inspired by Jason Barrera's work with Previews, and I watched them just for the value of synchronicity and to look at the parallels. Not realizing that they're the exact same length of time to the second. So if you start them both at the moment that their production intros fade out, they end at the exact same time. I also didn't realize when I watched them together initially that it was produced by Tony and Ridley Scott, The Gray was. And so Ridley Scott obviously did Alien. And what I also didn't realize is that Tony Scott killed himself within 3 months of the Gray's release. And the amount of parallels between them is absolutely fucking uncanny. Even like there's spooky stuff getting into how he died. He jumped off of a bridge in L.A. and hit beams, I guess, on the way down because they said that he had blunt head trauma after
he jumped
the fall.
Off the rainbow bridge and hit some paths on the way down.
Yes, exactly. And if you watch like The Gray, there's, you know, at the end of it, you have this guy, they jump off this cliff onto a tree, and there's a guy that hits all these branches on the way down, then gets eaten by the cliffotic wolves at the tree's base. And then you have this other guy shortly after that drowns in a river. Now the word for light, or a word for light in Hebrew, is the same as river. I don't have my that notebook handy where I have that kind of stuff, so I can actually people can look it up. But they have the idea that you have rivers running from Bina, or excuse me, the rivers running from Chokhmah collect in Bina and then they get distributed to the rest of the tree. And this is why they also look at it as light emanating down the tree, right? And so I was like, well, that's kind of freaky. Like, he drowns, he gets blunt head trauma and drowns. And then these characters at the end of The Gray had the same thing. And then you have this, if you look at like the score song titles for The Gray are all like, what is it? Writing the Letter is the first one. And then Suicide is the second one. The third one is You Are Gonna Die. it's like, and yeah, there's a lot to this, but I don't know. This completely tripped me out.
So just so you know, because David, I think one of the things you discovered in there was amazing to me is that Ripley, Sigourney Weaver's character, Ripley, at the end, her pod number is 723. There's actually
the last shot of the film.
So she's in a pod marked 723. And now you keep saying about Rivers, and you keep saying Rivers Run. I assume Bill is thinking Joyce in the background. but you realize that 723, what it marks is the Nile inundation. So it's the idea of the river overflowing.
Ooh, and they find the river, and then they're following the river, and then that's how he comes to the den. Oh, shit. That's so interesting. And then also the fact that it's 723, if you play them together, then you have the wolves as Sirius. So they're literally being like pushed out by Sirius. So this is the thing. So I watched that film just assuming the first time I watched it, just going into it, that they were already dead when the plane crashes, and then they're wandering around and they're resisting their own death. So it's like a purgatory kind of thing. And if you look at the wolves in that way, then they become their liberators and they're afraid of their liberator.
Very interesting.
Also, Tony Scott died on Bicycle Day, Hoffman's Bicycle Day. So the discovery of LSD, and then his name happens to be Tony, which is short for Anthony. And then the patron saint of ergot poisoning is Saint Anthony, which they refer to as Saint Anthony's fire. Right. So there's your catcher in the rye connection.
You just made me realize something. I think it's is the first. Holy shit. I've never thought of it this way. Kevin started this with, my Skype icon is still the book cover to look at all the happy creatures. Well, the first, very first page of Look at All the Happy Creatures is talking about this guy who's just been, it's actually a monkey, which we can make this big think of 2001. Oh my God, I'm thinking about this own, my own thing. But basically, it starts with a monkey, and he's just been tortured, and it's saying, he's touching his own body and saying it feels like he thinks that he's touching the corpse of a dead animal, and it finds it impossible to believe he's touching his own body. And then page two begins with says, "I'm dead." And then the next one says, "Huh?" And he's thinking, "Am I dead? Now I'm going to have to read my own story with the idea that are these characters actually dead?" Because
awesome.
The monk, and then the monkey says, "I'm dead," and he's responded by a dog. There's the dog next to him says, like, "What?" And he says, he says, "I'm dead," and the dog says, "Huh?" And the monkey responds, "We are the dead." Oh my God. Okay.
This was another thing. So I just happened to come across. So 1 Kings 7:23 in the Bible is where you'll find pi. So I posted that somewhere else. I could probably hold on a second. There's this whole, I might have to come back to it, but that's like the verse after it introduces the Oz pillars. So Joachim and Boaz show up in talking about Solomon's temple in the verse before. Pi shows up. So people have that three is pointed to, and they think that that's interesting in the first place. Like here in 1 Kings, you have them describing a circle and they give the whole thing, and then you can extrapolate that is three. But what people don't realize is that on top of that, I have to do this from memory because I can't find it. That word that they use for line in Hebrew, when it shows up in the Tanakh, they don't use the actual normal spelling. They include another letter, which changes it from... So normally it would be 106, but they make it 111. And then you can actually find that the second part of pi through that. I'm not giving this justice at all. But anyways, there's this really fascinating way that you can derive pi from the gematria in 1 Kings when it's describing a circle. But then what I was tripping out on was that it was pointed out, I watched the movie Stoker, which was really interesting, which was produced by Tony Scott, Ridley Scott's brother who killed himself. And the girl in it named India is sitting there reading the History of Pi. Now, in the History of Pi, this is the earliest introduction of the idea of pi is actually in the Bible, if you look at it through that lens. I don't know if this is actually in the book, but it should be one way or the other. But isn't it interesting that in the film Life of Pi, where the Indian boy survives the sinking of the Tsimshian, the name of the boat, it's Tsimshian, which is the contraction for creation to happen. So you have this idea for in order for the emanations of the tree to extend from the Ein Sof, you have this this necessary contraction, which the name for that contraction in Kabbalah is actually the name of the ship that sinks in Life of Pi. And isn't it interesting that the girl reading the History of Pi is named India, and here you have this Indian whole movie, and the way that the Tsimshian is represented, I was looking at this in a book from, it might be from the 14th century, I'd have to check, but the way the Tsimshian represented is simply as a circle with a dot in the middle. That's how they represent it, because the Ein Sof is literally spreading out the primordial waters to insert the shaft of light. And so they have this like this contraction represented as a circle with a dot in the middle. And so that's how you get pi. Pretty trippy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the circle with the dot in the middle is also the circumpunct, which Chris Knowles has connected to Sirius, being that it's the – so like, obviously it's an old alchemical symbol for the sun – but Kevin pointed out, is it the sun or is it the spiritual sun? And the idea that the circumpunct is the dot with that binary star around it.
Right. And exactly. And so when it's 1 Kings 7:23 that reveals pi, it's describing it as the circle in Solomon's temple between the two pillars.
That's really interesting too, because if pi is, you know, continuous, like an eternal number, right? Then it points at the nature of eternity, which is the function of the child or the prince. You know, like the king always dies, but the prince is the eternal flow, you know. So Sirius as the child slash prince slash pi between the two pillars, you know, it seems like Sirius is really attracted to this principle of eternity and like regeneration, you know.
Totally. Yeah. I'm tripping out.
So I'm living in North Carolina now, and there's this moving company called Aaron's, and I see their trucks everywhere, and it's this picture of a dog, like this cartoon dog, and it says Aaron's. And I don't know why I don't normally think in biblical terms, but I keep thinking of – isn't Aaron Moses's brother? Do I have that right?
Yeah.
So right. When you just keep saying the prince, well, who's the prince of Egypt? But Moses, and everywhere I go around here, I keep seeing his brother, the dog.
So,
you know, I know this has been covered many times before, but I'm wondering, Kevin, if maybe it wouldn't be helpful just to let's just take 5 minutes and can we review some of the classic idea of the dog star and Weepus the rabbit, why these are connected, and you know, the idea of the dog chasing the rabbit and stuff like that, and some of that material. I just think it would be helpful if someone's new to this, just even take a few minutes to review some of that.
Yeah, definitely. I actually compiled some notes last night and was like breaking through on some exciting stuff that I'm sure everyone is also pretty aware of, but I just don't know how, if it's all been mashed together enough yet. But so basically, you know, Sirius, I guess, like enters the whole sync web with Robert Anton Wilson, who is an author who, you know, started writing about conspiracy and occultism. And his work just kind of tried to highlight some of the more unspoken aspects of life when one takes on mystical states of consciousness. And what Robert Anton Wilson found was he was attracted to this star Sirius on 7/23/1974, I want to say. He woke up in the morning. I believe he might have been practicing some kind of magical ritual of sorts and had a vision of a man telling him that Sirius would be very important for him. He ran down to the library, looked into Sirius, and it turned out that the morning of his vision was the morning that in ancient Egypt, the Nile would be flooded and marked by the rising of Sirius before the sun. So Robert Anton Wilson wrote a couple of books, like most namely Cosmic Trigger, where he highlights basically Sirius as a synchronistic attractor, and he associates it with the white rabbit or the trickster deity, because as his life got more and more synchronistic, he felt as if he was being played with by some kind of intelligence. And an archetype that is attracted to that quality of experience would be the white rabbit, which comes from probably Celtic lore of the Fuka, the white rabbit. So you go a little further down the line, you know, at the same time, Robert Anton Wilson is having his serious synchronicities with the Dog Star. You've got Philip K. Dick, who is writing Valis in the 70s, and he also was having experiences of mystical contact. And in Valis, he goes on to say that he believes the source of this extraterrestrial contact is being beamed from Sirius. There's a lot of interesting stuff. Even Philip K. Dick marked his contact with the number 2374. So you've got 23 and Sirius from Robert Anton Wilson coming up as a sync attractor. And then you've got Philip K. Dick on an unconnected route having experiences in February and March of 1974 with Sirius that he marks with just the number code 2374, which brings in, you know, 237 from The Shining and all that too. So interestingly enough, you've got Philip K. Dick and Robert Anton Wilson both believing they're being receiving these beams of synchronistic data from Sirius. You go a little further back than both of those fellows, and we have Alice Bailey, who was a theosophist working with Madame Blavatsky. And Alice Bailey created a cosmology, and she believed at the very source of the cosmology, the most prime source of energy that informs human consciousness, is Sirius. And so she believes that, you know, all information is basically a compressed form of information from Sirius is what you've got Alice Bailey saying. So in terms of synchronicity and mysticism, we've got Robert Anton Wilson, Philip K. Dick, and Alice Bailey all believing that something is being beamed from Sirius. Interestingly enough, Alice Bailey taught that the way that Sirius communicates its energy down to the physical world on Earth is through this thing called the Rainbow Bridge. And this Rainbow Bridge is literally the bridge that bonds spirit and matter. And so we've got the rainbow being invoked by Bailey in conjunction with Sirius. I started writing about Sirius after I saw The Matrix, where I noticed Keanu Reeves, who plays in a band called Dogstar, interacting with a movie called Night of the Lepus on the TV screen in a scene in The Matrix. I noticed, you know, the Lepus constellation is the rabbit, the white rabbit, and the Dog Star is just above the rabbit, you know. So the Dog Star is said to chase the white rabbit. And so you've got Keanu Reeves, who plays in a band called Dog Star, chasing the white rabbit in The Matrix. I started picking up on some kind of pattern there where it seemed like, you know, actual constellations were finding themselves reflected on the screen. So when you go a little bit deeper, you find that the Lepus constellation, the white rabbit, was known to the Egyptians as the boat to the underworld. I think it was known most often as the boat of Osiris. But when you get into boats, you invoke the understanding of the Merkaba, or the body of light. So boats in mysticism often refer to the soul, which carries the spiritual essence through the spiritual journey. So if Sirius, the Dog Star, represents our spiritual nature, then and our spiritual light from the spiritual sun, just below the Dog Star, we've got the boat to the other world, represented by a white rabbit, resonating with the body of light vessel known as the Merkaba or the boat of light. So I started picking up on, like, okay, so it seems like the white rabbit in pop culture resonates with spiritual mysteries, the mysteries of the spiritual world, and that Sirius represents our nature in that world. Sirius is our animating light in the spiritual dimension. So going a little bit further down the line, you've got in the Matrix associations between Neo and Alice from Alice in Wonderland. You know, Alice and Neo both represent initiates into the mysteries, and they both follow the White Rabbit. As Robert Anton Wilson thought, and I also thoroughly believe, the White Rabbit is a reflection of our relationship to our higher self. The White Rabbit is the bridge. It is the membrane between, you know, the worldly self and the self beyond worldly self. And so going a little bit deeper into that, you've got Alice in Wonderland. She's hanging out with her dog, follows the White Rabbit into the hole, explores all these mysteries. And when she gets down there, she encounters rule number 42 in the court of the queen. In Egyptian mysticism, there would be the courts of Maat in the underworld or the afterlife. And in those courts, you must satisfy 42 principles in order for your heart to be light as a feather and for you to go on into the other world. So we've got in both Alice in Wonderland and Egyptian mysticism, the entrance into the other world and then the presence of the number 42. That 42 from the Egyptian underworld that you get to through a white rabbit jumped out at me because you've got Alice in Wonderland following the rabbit with a 42. You've got the Egyptian feather of Maat and her underworld being represented by 42. Then you go to Donnie Darko and Frank, the white rabbit, gives Donnie the number 42 on his arm. You go into films like Ghosts, you can see Patrick Swayze in a subway as a ghost in the afterlife on 42nd Street for a good chunk of the film. And then it just goes on from there. There's just like many films like Poltergeist, which, you know, deals with the relationship of our world and another world. And the TV in that film is locked on 42 as it becomes a stargate to that other world. The address is 4267. Even 6 times 7 is 42 if you split that up a little bit. And it just kind of goes on from there in a lot of ways. There's like, it's like kind of an infinite number of movies that seem to resonate this connection. But what it seems like in the end for me is that Sirius is kind of asking for our attention again. It's asking for us to remember our spiritual nature, and the White Rabbit or the mysteries or the path to that side is what is kind of like reaching out through Sync and through all this stuff. Forgive me if that was a bit mashed up, because there's so many movies and ideas that play into this stuff. But
I just want to add to your idea of the Merkaba and Alice in Wonderland following the rabbit, all this sort of stuff, is that when Lewis Carroll first told the story of Alice in Wonderland, before he had written it, he told it. He was on a boat. He was on the river Isis, which is associated with Sirius.
Yep.
And the day he first told it, I'd have to actually look it up.
But July 4th.
Yeah, sorry.
That's right.
July 4th, exactly, which is also a day that marks a significant point. I think this is July 4th is where Sirius is in alignment with the sun. It's the
precisely,
Sirius
yeah.
is in conjunction with the sun. So he tells it while Sirius is in alignment with the sun. He's on a boat on the Isis River when he first tells this story.
Right. And then so just to finish the last chunk of this 42 White Rabbit Rainbow Bridge to the spirit dimension theme. I didn't mention the thing about the Wizard of Oz, which kind of ties into the Alice in Wonderland thing you mentioned again. The author of the Wizard of Oz was part of the Theosophical Society as well as Alice Bailey. And at the time that the Wizard of Oz was being written, Alice Bailey was also developing her Rainbow Bridge cosmology. And, you know, basically Alice Bailey's trip was that, you know, in order to get back in touch with our spiritual nature, we needed to reunite with this spiritual, you know, rainbow bridge and connect with that. So the Wizard of Oz is literally about following the dog Toto over the rainbow bridge to find that there is no great wizard, there is no great other, but that all is a reflection of self, you know. And so even in The Wizard of Oz, we have these themes of going into another world, going over the rainbow, following a dog, and learning the mysteries of self, you know? And so I really don't know, I can't confirm this or not, but I might be the first person to really claim that The Wizard of Oz is may have been inspired by Alice Bailey's Antikorana teachings. There's a good few chunks of these, the stories and the cosmology, that line up pretty well, but I still can't know if they're intentional, you know?
You did the first blog that I ever got into, Kevin.
Oh, that's awesome.
Live from the Logosphere blew my mind. And it didn't just blow my mind because it was, I mean, there's a lot of things I had never considered, but that particular connection that you just pointed out, I had crossed my mind. Mm-hmm. And so the most riveting aspect of your blog was the pieces that it filled in, the what the significance was of some of those connections. It blew my mind. I can't help but, so not only was there that with Alice Bailey, with Alice in Wonderland, but realize that Alice's teacher at the beginning of Alice in Wonderland is named Helena. And so you have Helena Blavatsky. And then if you watch the film Eyes Wide Shut, which like the cover for, you can see you have an Alice looking into a mirror, right? Uh-huh. There's this whole mirror thing. But her daughter in the film, Alice's daughter, Nicole Kidman's daughter, is named Helena. And at the beginning of the film, she's seen studying, just like Alice is studying at the beginning of Alice in Wonderland. But what's interesting that's come up lately is that in the film Stoker, the girl who plays India played Alice in the miniseries of Alice in Wonderland? I forget, but she played Alice in a version of Alice in Wonderland. And so she's Alice's daughter in Eyes Wide Shut. Now, like, if you get what I'm... crossing over here, it's kind of complicated. But... and so I like also that the dad is Tom Cruise is Dr. Bill in Eyes Wide Shut, while you have Bill is the lizard in Alice in Wonderland. But let me see here. I'm reading notes that I had, and I'm realizing that what I was going to say was already stated by Alan, which was the Isis River thing, and that Helena Blavatsky's first book is Isis Unveiled. And so that's just, it's a total mind fuck. And then also remember that Nicole Kidman was in that film Rabbit Hole, which was all of Donnie Darko implied portals of time travel.
Thank you. Consider the fact that in Alice in Wonderland, the rabbit is constantly holding a clock, right? So when you say about time travel, he's holding a clock. When Dave Bowman goes to Saturn, Saturn is not only the god of the underworld, but the god of time. So I'm saying that time travel, in a weird sort of way, is visiting the world of the dead. Because if you go back in time, you're visiting the spirits of the dead. They're alive. You're going to where they now live. They live in the past, right? So to go back in time, it is the same idea. This, we could take this to Nicole Kidman's other roles in, like, you know, what is it, The Others or whatever. But
where she talks about Alice, or where she talks about The Wizard of Oz. She tells the story of The Wizard of Oz to the little girl in Dogville. That's just huge. Anyway,
so but just this idea that. So you have the clock, and Donnie Darko, as you pointed out, the wormhole on the screen is actually coming out of a clock.
Wow.
So it's just this idea of to what I'm realizing is sort of to transcend time or to go back in time. And this actually goes to the whole idea of all right, how do I explain this? So there's the this idea that the people who are desiring a return to the age of Saturn, this is something Chris Knowles has written about many times. I'm not going to be able to do it justice, but this idea is that there's this group of people who would want to return to an age of Saturn, the golden age of Saturn, and that there's is this incorporation of a reversal of time motif. Now, when he was writing this a few years back, he seemed to propose the idea that this was intentional, almost media ritual, I don't know if he still holds that belief or if he's come to take it as sort of more of a archetypal, you know, just expression of these desires, these innate symbols. Regardless, he touched on the idea of that the reversal of time motif as trying to go back to an age of Saturn. So what would end up happening is if we have the dog chasing the rabbit down the rabbit hole, what we would instead have is the rabbit chasing the dog, right?
Mm.
And Kevin, one of the things that I love that you did is you incorporated Bugs Bunny, right? So you have this idea of where Bugs Bunny's always sort of turning the tables.
Right.
And Bugs Bunny is famous for doing weird sort of portally things where he like sticks his feet down one hole and his ears come out another or something. So he's very much, you know, doing some sort of weird temporal displacement or space-time teleportation. Now, earlier in this show, you were talking about the twin pillars of Yakin and Boaz, and you pronounced it, the way I heard it was more like a Yako. And I don't know, does anyone remember a TV show called Animaniacs?
Of course.
Yeah.
So what, I don't
Steven remember, Spielberg.
It's another Steven Spielberg. It's the characters are trapped in this water tower vault of like discarded ideas. Mm-hmm. So it just takes us to Kubrick's water tower that's, you know, with the in Your Majesty Satan or whatever on the water tower, or however, if you want to go there with it. But they're trapped in the water tower. They're basically these characters that are, you know, coming out into the real world, if I remember the idea correctly. And I don't remember the other characters' names, but I know one of them was Yako, right?
Mm.
I don't know. I was hoping someone here would remember it better than me.
Sorry.
Because they're also kind of rabbit figures.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I was getting. That's what I was getting to, because they are rabbits.
Yeah.
There's something you were talking about the connection to time and stuff. I had like a brief thought about Sirius and 23 that I thought was really interesting yesterday. And going back into the mirror theme that we kind of kicked off with, 23, W is the 23rd letter of the English alphabet. And when you take W, you could speak it out as W. And, when we're talking about like these kind of spiritual, physical membrane themes, you've got your physical you, and then you've got your starry self, you know, your starry nature. So 23 being a pointer towards Sirius can also be seen as W, which is another hint back at our starry nature, which I think Sirius is like a big pointer toward. And then interestingly enough, sorry. I'm sorry, this part's good, I think. The interesting thing is that when you take 23 and W, when you transpose English to Hebrew for the letters, the letter shin becomes W. And even the English letter W kind of reflects the three flames of the W in the Hebrew letter shin. So shin, the Hebrew letter for W, already represents the spiritual flame of beingness, basically. And that Hebrew letter is given the tarot card, the Last Judgment, which is in the old aeon or the old times, a card that referred to the Last Judgment, you know, from the Bible, where souls are reunited with their bodies and descend into heaven again, you know. But if you take Aleister Crowley's new Aeon approach to that Last Judgment card, the W, Shin, or 23 card, you get the Aeon. And Aleister Crowley believed the Aeon was simply a time where we would realize our starry nature. And so to Crowley, the Last Judgment was not a time where souls would necessarily literally rise from the dead into their bodies, but it would be a time that humans in the now could realize their spiritual nature in the present and not have it be a spiritual judgment or a end of the world, but it was a transformation of the world by spiritual fire. So Sirius, 23, Shin, the Aeon, all seem to point toward the activation of our spiritual source, Sirius, you know. And if you go a little bit deeper, you know, Crowley's order, which I'm a member of, is called the Order of the Silver Star. And again, the central archetype of our philosophy is the child, which could easily be associated with Sirius when you have Father Sun and Mother Moon on the pillars of the Tree of Life and such. So I just think it's something really interesting there with the W, the Aeon, starry nature, Sirius, 23, all that, you know. Just wanted to throw that in there.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, like, so for me, I think of the W as the wave. You know how they think of matters being both a point and a wave?
Right.
So if W is our wave and that translates into 23, well, I always think of 23 as 2 cubed, which transforms into an 8, which is just an infinity sign turned up, you know, standing upright. That's and awesome, infinity is really that dot inside that circle where it's the center and the circumference all at once.
Yep.
So you have W equals 23 equals infinity. So you have your matter that transforms itself through those three different representations. But, you know, on each side of the equal sign, it's its own specific individual being. So in much the way that 23 transforms that way, you know, you have 237, room 237, right? Which I think maybe it was your blog that pointed out that that equals 42.
Yeah, I did write about that a bit, yeah.
So, you know, 237 equals 42. Well, 42 is just 2 times 4 equals 8. So you have this you have this continual return to infinity. But once you get to infinity, you go back to the wave, which is the river, which is, you know, you go from the ocean to the river to the story. And we just are sort of, we're going back and forth between these two places. But the oddness of it is that we never go anywhere at all. This is just happening in our mind. This is the illusion. This is Maya, right?
So
we look out at Sirius and we see across a couple of equal signs and we think that there's the mystery. But really, the mystery is right there with us. You know, there's somebody on Sirius looking at Earth thinking it's much better over here. And what a disappointment it would be for them to make that trip. And they're like, what's this about? What's racism? And, you know, all the stupid first grade shit we're still dealing with. So, you know, this idea of the Aeon, of being able to realize, you know, like, I love the name of your band, man, because you know, that's, it's not night, it's space. It's, we're in space. What, we're on the spaceship. Why can't we just accept that right now?
right.
So,
and yeah, everything falls aside from that cosmic perspective, you know, like all the dualities of this earthbound, paradigm, you know.
And you know, we were talking about a lot of stuff that makes me think of the word in regards to mirroring is the word convoluted. And whenever I hear convoluted, I'm kind of programmed by society to think it's a whacked out waste of time. You know, it's crazy talk, right? But really the definition of convoluted is it is just to twist something to make it more intricate, right? So when Kubrick says with 2001 he convolutes McLuhan, he doesn't mean to dismantle it anyway. He's just twisting it. You know, he says to convolute McLuhan in 2001, the message is the medium. And I think of probably the greatest convolution of all time that completely changed my inner thinking is, and it's written about in, I think it's in Cosmic Trigger, but I'm not sure. But Wilson goes on to talk about how Freud states that the unconscious is not aware of its mortality, which is a pretty huge thought to really process. Oh, yeah. You know, to go from monkey to human and then to process that there's something called the unconscious that's alive and is not controlling you, but it's influencing you and you don't even know it, right? That's a pretty huge concept to really grasp. But Aleister Crowley convolutes Freud and says the unconscious is aware of its immortality.
Right.
And I wanted to know what your thoughts are on that twist that Aleister Crowley made and how that sort of has informed your work, or how that kind of thought has impacted your work.
That's like the best question for me, honestly, because, you know, I've been like writing about this stuff a lot, and like, I don't know why, but for many years, I've just been like really dedicated to discovering like proof that we're more than what is handed down to us by science and by culture and by, you know, materialism and all that kind of stuff. So for whatever reason, there's just a total natural drive in me to bring attention and realization toward our nature beyond physicality and stuff. And so I really resonate with anyone's work that kind of expounds on that nature. And yeah, I really do think that this is something that Jay Coetzee was just explaining beautifully on a Syncast the other day, which is that, you know, all suffering is the product of a form of ignorance. And I would say it's not the form of ignorance that you can choose, but it's a natural form of ignorance where we're born into this world. We take on awareness, but what we have forgotten, I think, is our starry nature, is our eternal narrative, which is beyond the egoic earthbound narrative. And so I really do believe, you know, more of Crowley's twist, that deep down we are aware that we are an epic, you know, process going on beyond time. And so I think the White Rabbit kind of jumps in there, and it gives us little hints. Like, I just had a sync the other day that connected me to my first concert when I was in fifth grade. And it just like stunned me how deep this sync was and how trans time it was. And it helped me realize that that's the White Rabbit is kind of giving us winks, is winking at us. It's ourself winking at us from beyond time, I think. And so, yeah, I really do believe, you know, deep down that we all have an understanding of our nature beyond form. And like Jay Coetzee said, it's just an ignorance that we take on early in this life, that we believe that we're limited to this body, this lifetime, or any one definition of being in general, you know? So yeah, I resonate with that stuff deeply. And I think the really interesting thing that you brought up, this convolution idea, it's like, this has been a big point for me recently, and it brings Philip K. Dick back into the picture. You know, like I said, a big theme for me is our nature, beyond form, and the membrane is the, what I highlight as our symbol of our connection to that great beyond. So Philip K. Dick, during the time of his mystical experiences, he believed that this thing called plasmate existed in man, and that it's like a divine medium that we are given as we're born into this world as both physical and spiritual beings, that this plasmate is what allows information to travel from the cosmic unconscious into the conscious intellectual mind. And, you know, Philip K. Dick equated the plasmate with the Holy Spirit, but, he also basically where plasmate comes from is the starry realm, is our nature beyond form. And he believed that reality was, a mix of these two worlds where we are forgetting about the spiritual world. We've totally forgot our starry nature. And, we exist in this world of having forgotten. So our starry nature is communicating to us through this plasmate, according to Philip K. Dick. And Philip K. Dick marks actually world ages in his experience, just like Aleister Crowley does. And the aeon for Philip K. Dick was the realization that there is a plasmate. So he believed that man being ignorant of his plasmate nature or starry nature caused the dark age of the Piscean era, basically, and that the realization of this plasmate and the reintegration of that awareness, what he calls the forgotten twin woman from the beginning of time,
the woman in the mirror.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so it's this great remembering, you know, and it's like, that's what I titled my notes last night, starry anamnesis, because anamnesis is a word that I think Plato used to speak about the process of learning. And he actually believed that learning is never actually anything that's happening for the first time, but that it's just instructions on how to remember. And so, you know, it really does seem like Sirius, this membrane, plasma, this bridge, the Aeon, it all points toward this great remembering of our nature. And I think, you know, we are at the end of a time where a monoculture and a monotheistic religion has kind of just kept our consciousness from even playing in those playgrounds of thought. So to go back to convolution really quick, and I'll end this thought, Philip K. Dick basically believed that Satan had something to do with this. And this brings back Lucifer, the Morning Star, and the realization of starry nature. Philip K. Dick, sorry, just give me one sec with my notes here, believed that the fall of Adam from the garden was a choice to follow the snake or the serpent, but it was not a, he calls it the great satanic blasphemy. It was when Adam decided to follow the serpent's orders and such, you know? So we've got Philip K. Dick saying that that is exactly what happened, that we did follow the serpent of wisdom out of the garden, but that it wasn't a bad thing, and that there's been a lot of convolution about what that fall really was. And it wasn't a fall that we were being punished for. It was a fall that we chose. We chose to descend from the world of spirit into matter. So this is, I think, an interesting thing where we get into you know, some of the Lucifer themes from other films like The Fallen Star, and King Felix. And yeah, yeah.